Welcome to the Derek Black Show, political news and talk, 1340 AM.
We're back with the Derek Black Show. We're in our closing up our ninth week. Pretty impressive. I know a lot of you didn't think we'd make it this long, but like I've said, the best is yet to come. I'm Don Black, sitting in for Derek the first few minutes of the program. He's got a previous engagement and can't quite get here on time, but he'll be here shortly. And our guest today will be Craig Boedeker. Now, Craig is, I've met him a couple of times. He is a filmmaker, an accomplished filmmaker. And the difference, though, is that he tells the truth. And he has produced a film called A Conversation About Race. Can you imagine such a thing? Now, normally when you hear that title, you would think it would have the usual liberal, multi-culti claptrap. But no, this is a real conversation about reality. And I saw the program, or the film, last summer at the Council of Conservative Citizens National Conference. And it's a great program for introducing people who may be on the fence or have never really thought about the reality of race. He produced the film by running classified ads, asking for people to come be interviewed, or where he would go interview them, asking them questions about their attitude toward race, and most of them parroted what they had been told all their lives by the biased news media and in our controlled education system. And then he would proceed to take apart their arguments. It's a great, great film. And we'll have him on at 10 o'clock today, and I'm sure you'll definitely want to hear what he has to say. He has a second film now, which you'll also be talking about, in which he, a follow-up to a conversation about race. And you can find it, by the way. You can buy the DVD. You can find the, in the interest of internet openness, you can find the video all around the net if you want to download it. But I recommend you buy it and support the work of Craig Boedeker. He spent a great deal of money and time producing this. It'll be on at 10. Well, last night I was watching CNN, Anderson Cooper, and we talked about this in my segment of the program Tuesday. All the big news about this fearsome militia in Michigan, Christian extremist, the media was labeling them. And my opinion on that, on what I had seen, was that this was just an attempt by the current administration to demonize opposition. There's an enormous amount of opposition out there with the Tea Parties and a great deal of latent resentment among the American people about what America is becoming, what our government is doing, which is betraying the American people, whether it be immigration opening the floodgates to even more immigration, third world immigration, which will turn this country inevitably into a third world country, or, of course, the increasing socialization and totalitarianism of the federal government. A lot of resentment out there. So it's important for the establishment, the political and the media establishment, to demonize this opposition. And they're doing so through this Michigan, not the Michigan militia, but it is a Christian militia in Michigan. And, of course, the story is that they were planning to kill police officers. They had some they didn't know just quite how, according to the federal government. They weren't quite sure what they were going to do. They were going to kill a police officer somehow, and then they were somehow going to attack the funeral procession, the hundreds more of law enforcement from around the country. Well, this is the story, and my impression of that was this: since they didn't actually have any explosives or explosive devices, they didn't have any illegal weapons, they had no way to accomplish what they're alleged to have intended to do, but they did have an informant who had been with their group for a year and a half. Now, normally when you find a situation like this, the crime has been instigated by the informant. It was all talk. There was no concrete plan to do anything. There was no ability to do anything. And I suspect the whole idea, all the talk, was instigated by this informant. That's the way it usually works. You either have a contract informant who's being paid to set up somebody, get a prosecution, or the other kind of informant is somebody that's been in trouble himself legally and is trying to stay out of jail. But either way, you have an informant who is motivated to create a crime. And I suspected that's what, I don't know the facts, of course, but I suspect that's what happened in this case. Now, these guys might be nuts. They kind of sound a little nutty. But it's not a crime to be nutty in this country yet. And they were mad at the federal government, which is not a crime yet either. So it looks to me like this is an attempt to demonize all opposition. And, of course, the idea of killing police officers is insane. Most cops are pretty much sympathetic to our point of view, at least privately. And the idea, this talk about killing police officers, and that's all it was, even if that was talk. So, but it sounds really bad. It's an effective way to demonize opposition. So for the first time, the media, of course, just eats this up. They just parrot whatever their authority figures tell them, whether it be the federal government, Department of Justice, or private groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center. I must have seen that grizzled Mark Pottock 36 times in the past few days. He's trotted out by all the major news media. And, of course, Pottock's agenda is to, pretty much the same as the federal government, to demonize any opposition to multiculturalism, to call it hate. And so he was talking about how this worrisome rise in militia patriot groups, which has taken place in the past couple of years, particularly since the election of Obama. And he goes on and on and on about this, of course. The other agenda of Mark Pottock and the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has nothing to do with poverty, of course. It's a very rich organization. It raises millions of dollars by milking its liberal contributors, by scaring them with talk of hate, the rise of hate in America. Their other agenda, of course, is to turn America into a third world country. They regularly file lawsuits against those who oppose immigration. They filed a lawsuit against a Texas rancher I think in 2006, who had been stopping illegal aliens from crossing his land. Filed a lawsuit, got a judgment, got his ranch. This is what the Southern Poverty Law Center does. But the media, of course, considers him a great authority on opposition to multiculturalism, which they and he and they call hate. Well, we call it love of our own country and love of our own people. It's not hate. I can honestly say I don't really hate anyone. On a personal level, I oppose those who would destroy my heritage, my values, and my culture, my country. But that's not hate. If somebody else, any other group, says they support, if they promote their own people, their own heritage, then of course that's all fine and good if they're black, brown, Jewish, whatever. But if white Christians do that, then they're immediately branded as hate. Well, for the first time last night, Anderson Cooper actually talked about this militia show objectively. He and the reporter that was with him, the reporter had been covering the story very closely, and the reporter pointed out that this group had no capability of doing anything, that it was all talk. And they even mentioned the word free speech. So for the first time, the media has shown some objectivity, some independence. But that tends to be the exception. Pretty much everything else is all about the terrible threat that has been averted by the arrest of this family and their supporters. They arrested the whole family of the leader, of course, including the 19-year-old son, which is also a tactic used by the federal government, because then pretty much ensures that the leader of the group will cooperate in exchange for not having his family prosecuted. That's a standard tactic, of course. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. But nevertheless, most Americans believe what they're told by the media, even though there are an increasing number that are able to think independently. But most still pretty much believe that a terrible threat has been averted. Now, as I mentioned on the last program, a lot of other things going on. There are Mexican gangs threatening law enforcement along the in border towns in the United States. Mexican gangs murdering, kidnapping, not only on the Mexican side of the border, but on the American side as well. Nobody talks about that. Media doesn't talk about that much. Not important to them. So your normal everyday murders and kidnappings, it's not news. But this militia, Christian extremist in Michigan, now that's news. Day after day, big news. We'll be right back. I want to talk in the few minutes I have remaining about censorship on the Internet.
We will be back with the Derek Black Show on WPBR 1340 AM.
Tonight on the Palm Beach Republican Party Cartoon Network, join Sid Dinerstein and the gang as they oppress white Europeans and trample their rights in Florida elections.
Dinerstein, how you whine. Your lies are just so feeble. And you're not fooling me, cause I can't see how much you hate white people. Dinerstein, it's a crime, a cold abuse of power. Let me tell you, Sid Black ain't no kid. said to you, he just won't cower. When you're going after Derek, it's hysteric how you rant and you rave. He's no slave. This Jewish double standard, how you pattered for a pat on the back from a pack. Dinah, Dinah Stein, out of your mind. You think you'll make us sparkle, but we won't run from you. And when we're through, you'll only make us chuckle. Dinah, Dinah Stein.
WPBR.
Welcome back to the Derek Black Show.
We're back. Derek Black will be here shortly. In the next few minutes, I want to talk about another side of this demonization of opposition, and that's direct censorship. Now, the national and much of the local news media for decades now has exercised censorship. It is because they have had a central control over information. When I was growing up, there were basically two networks. News operations. ABC didn't have one. So it was CBS and NBC, broadcast networks. And that was pretty much what where most people got their information, was from the evening news on one of these two networks. And then, of course, we had newspapers, but they had mostly become part of big national chains. They were owned by big national chains. And those chains tended to dictate the editorial and news policy of those newspapers. When I grew up in North Alabama, the newspaper, our local newspaper, was the Huntsville Times. And the Huntsville Times in the 50s was an independent paper, and it reflected the views of the local people. Now, I just barely remember the 50s. I was born in 53, but when I got older, the Huntsville Times had become very liberal. It's the most liberal paper in the state of Alabama. Alabama's a conservative state, of course. But it was a fairly liberal paper. And I wondered about this. So I went back and looked at the old microfilm copies of the Huntsville Times in our local library. And I went back to the 50s, and the editorial policy, news coverage policy, was totally different. I had editorials by Carlton Putnam and others who were racial realists, who believed that integration simply wasn't going to work. Forced integration of the races would not work. It reflected the views of the local people of Alabama at the time. And then all of a sudden in the early 60s, it changed radically. Well, the reason it changed was because the newspaper was bought. It was bought by the New York Newhouse family. And Newhouse bought the Birmingham News as well. They bought the Mobile. The three biggest newspapers in the state were bought by a New York newspaper conglomerate. And the editorial and news coverage policy changed radically when that happened. It no longer reflected the views of the people of Alabama. A whole new agenda was put in place. And that agenda, of course, was the multiculturalist agenda, which has destroyed America in the past few decades and the ensuing decades, and it continues to destroy it. Well, that's how the news media works. But then all of a sudden, in the 90s, something called the Internet came along. Now, the Internet had been around since the 70s, but it had been set up as a tool to... just a communications medium, primarily for scientists and some military people and some government people to communicate, send messages to each other, basically. Well, in the 90s, the early 90s, the internet was still very difficult to use. And most people had never heard of it in 1993. As late as 1993, most people had never heard of the internet. And it wasn't accessible to most people. You had to be a member of some or an employee of some big research corporation or the military, and some universities had the internet. Well, then it became more accessible, and then with a new protocol called the World Wide Web, which is not the same as the internet, the World Wide Web was a protocol, a hypertext linking protocol, which made it very easy to browse the internet, to browse websites, which we all take for granted today, but nobody had ever heard of such a thing back in the early 90s. Well, the internet exploded as a result of this. And in 1995, I believe, America Online, which was the biggest online service which had ignored the internet, made its network compatible with the net. And then just about everybody could be on the internet. Now, of course, your phone company offers service. It's almost a given. Most people have internet access, of course. And it's fairly cheap. And it is almost completely unregulated. Well, this took the media establishment, by surprise. It wasn't expecting this to happen. An unregulated alternative news source. Well, that's what we've got. So in ensuing years, we've had various attempts to censor the net. And this is included. Some countries have tried to actually block access to certain websites like mine. Germany tried to do that. That didn't work very well. People just set up mirrors around or individual users can use proxies to get around these kind of blocks. We had censoring software, which is promoted primarily to protect your children from pornography. We have censoring software, and which some libraries, many libraries use. And what they do is, in addition to porn, they also block other sites which they find offensive. And they don't tell you what sites they're blocking, but they block politically unacceptable sites. The politically incorrect sites are blocked as well. So this is one of the tricky methods that have been used to censor the net. But most people still don't use this software. Well, another method is to censor search engines. Most people use search engines to find what they want. And the biggest search engine of all now is Google. It really came out of nowhere about 10 years ago. There were a lot of search engines around. Google wasn't one of them. Nobody had ever heard of Google. And then within a couple of years, because of the approach they took to indexing sites and ranking sites, the algorithms, sophisticated algorithms they use to try to find relevant results based on keywords, the most relevant results, they came out of nowhere and became the biggest search engine of all. Now, 2/3 of all search engine traffic is through Google. So censoring through Google has become important for a lot of people, a lot of countries. And Google, of course, has gotten a lot of publicity recently because it's pulled out of mainland China, because the Chinese were trying to censor its search results. And Google tried to go along with this for a while, but it just didn't work. The Chinese were too aggressive in censoring politically, what they considered politically unacceptable material. But China is not the only country where Google has trouble. There was an article yesterday, an Associated Press article that was carried various news outlets. It said, Google has Censorship Balancing Act outside China. And it talks about various countries that insist that Google not carry certain web pages. the Turkey has a problem. Thailand's monarch was supposed to be shielded from public ridicule by blocking unflattering videos in their home countries. France, Spain want certain sites blocked. Free nations, we hear. And one of the sites they want blocked is Stormfront itself. Germany, of course, is the biggest one. They want my site blocked. Germany will not allow Google to list Stormfront at all in their search results for that country. France, England is another one. Surprisingly, they have certain pages that they have served Google with a legal letter, basically, cease and desist letter version of it. And Google will block certain pages on my site, not the whole site, but certain pages. Kind of an odd selection, too. I can go into my account on Google, and they will list the pages that have been blocked in these countries because these countries claim that they violate their local laws. Nothing's illegal in the United States. It's on our site. In fact, it's constitutionally protected. But some countries do not like certain ideas, so they block them. And this article shows has a graphic sidebar in which they show how searching on stormfront.org produces different results in different countries. Some countries it doesn't produce any results at all because it's blocked completely. So this is just another method of censorship, trying to censor Google. And I have to give credit to Google. They've stood up overall. They've stood up pretty well against these attempts to censor their search results. I don't know if that's going to remain the case, but so far, they index everything except child pornography. Anything that's legal, they index. It's legal in this country. So Google has an enormous power over the net. Again, two-thirds of all search engine traffic goes through Google. So Google can censor if they decide to do that at some point. So we will see. It's very difficult for me to believe that that a free and open alternative news source like the Internet will remain free forever. But it depends on, much of it depends on what we do, all of us do, to stand up for our own interests and our own rights. And many, there's still in this country, and in to a lesser degree in other countries, a lot of people that really do believe in the First Amendment or in free speech. Most countries don't have a First Amendment equivalent, but we do in this country. And most Americans, I believe, still think it's worthwhile to ensure that the freedom to express one's opinion without going to jail, as happens in Canada, Germany, many other countries, where you can go to jail just for expressing your opinion. Nothing illegal, not promoting any kind of violence, anything like that. Just expressing your opinion on race, on historical events, can land you in prison in some of these countries. Happens all the time. We've had people go to jail in Germany just for posting on Stormfront, posting completely legal material, in no way advocates violence, just posting your opinion. You can go to jail. Well, we don't have that in this country yet. And I think we do have a strong sentiment among the American people. Not everybody. Some people think it's just dandy for people to go to jail for expressing their opinions if they don't agree with them. We've had one caller on this program said that. A couple of callers, actually. But most Americans don't believe that. And I think that this free and unencumbered media will continue to make an enormous difference. There's a lot of resentment out there among the American people, among others in other countries, and it depends on us all of us who know what's going on, all of you listening who know what's going on, to stand up and make a difference. Americans are looking for leadership. They're looking for the answers. You have to provide it for them. I'm Don Black. Derek Black's in the studio. We will be right back.
TV movies as Evil White Men Massacre and Enslave Innocent Non-White Minorities, and the critically acclaimed hit Evil White Men Massacre and Enslave Innocent Non-White Minorities Part 2. But today I'm here to talk to you about a different matter, a matter that is close to my heart, that of the Mosquito Relief Fund. Did you know that over 200 billion mosquitoes are murdered every year in the state of Florida alone? That's well, it works out to a lot of them every day. But here at the Mosquito Relief Fund, we work to save these poor, innocent victims by providing them with food and shelter and adoption for the many orphan children that are left to fend for themselves. But we can't do it alone. We need your help. With as little as $683 a day, you can help feed and clothe a mosquito child, like Saquita here, for example. Her parents were slaughtered by a bug zapper 2 years ago, no doubt by white people. And she was left abandoned with no one to care for her. Just listen to her heart-wrenching story. So please, please won't you help? It takes so little to bring hope into a mosquito's life. Why, you little bugger? Oh my God, what have I done? Oh, the white girl! Oh,
Welcome back to the Derek Black Show.
And welcome to the program today. This is Thursday. It was April 1st, so I don't know. Maybe we'll pull an April Fool's joke, and I'm Derek Black, finally into the studio. First half hour done by my father, the co-host with Paul Harvey or news or whatever it is. You know, all the good commentary filling in for the first half hour for me. I'm on the rebound from a flu, too.
I know. I'm really impressed with the effectiveness of my vitamins and supplements I made you take yesterday.
Uh-huh. It turned into a 24-hour walking flu.
I know. It's just remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I should start selling this stuff on the program, you know.
What is it that I took, by the way? Maybe it would be helpful.
Oh, it's wellness formula. I've looked around at all. For those who don't know, I'm I follow alternative medicine and
that sounds very mystical.
Mystilets. No, alternative medicine is...
You have quartz crystals and stuff?
No, I don't go that far, actually. I do believe in nutritional therapy, and I've learned quite a bit about it over the last 40 years. I'm not a doctor. I used to work in the medical field back in the 70s and 80s. Worked for an ear, nose, and throat doctor, who always told me, he was actually like a second father to me. You met him, of course, mm-hmm. before he died. He always told me never to trust doctors. even though our treatments were fairly conventional, but I learned a lot from him. And I do believe that nutritional therapy can work. There's a lot of quackery out there, of course, and it's not something that you should take. Some things you need to do, some of the claims need to be taken with a grain of salt. But anyway, obviously it worked for you.
What did I take? I took three, six actually in a day. What was that? Was it herbs?
It was a combination of mushrooms, echinacea, of course, astragalus, various herbs, a bunch of herbs and vitamins.
Just a bunch of herbs and vitamins. So you're not going to give what it was so that people have to come to you and pay you to find out?
Well, that's an idea. I haven't thought about that. We can't get any advertising on this program, so we should.
It didn't really work out quite well. I guess, but echinacea, was that in it or what? Because I was already
echinacea
sick
was
when
one
I first
of the. Echinacea
it.
Works for most people, I think. Most people say echinacea works by itself, but this included a number of other things.
And
as
it was
well.
One of those flus that developed during the day. I woke up in the morning and I was fine, but by about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, I was really awful. And I had one feverish night and woke up this morning and it was fine.
Well, there's our testimonial right there. That's called anecdotal evidence, of course. But anecdotal.
And everybody knows it's just because of my strong immune system anyway. You know, I have the strongest immune system outside of Lance Armstrong's. And so that's just what did it, actually.
Well, you do. That's actually true. You've never been sick much your entire life throughout
mm-hmm.
childhood. The last time you saw a doctor when you were sick was when you were, I think, 6 months old.
Yeah, well, see, there you go. You know, I get my immune system's compromised, and immediately it responds, and it fixes it up right in one night. Although I did have a bunch of weird fever dreams all during the night. Couldn't escape from them either. It was one of those ones where you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you wish the dreams would stop, but then you have to go back to sleep, and they begin again.
Yeah,
one long, weird dream.
I have those dreams every night. I wake up exhausted.
You have fever dreams every night?
I wake up exhausted from all my dreams. I'm fighting somebody. I'm doing something precarious.
I wasn't fighting anybody. I was lost in this, like, Tron world where furniture was flying around, and it was everybody's job to follow it and try to capture the furniture because it was just flying around and getting connected, and table legs and chairs and stuff were getting all hooked together, and we had to chase it down. And then at the end, we realized that the inverse was sucking it all up. I don't know what the inverse was, but it was like a black hole, and it was eating all the furniture.
Well, that makes you glad to wake up when you have those
I woke up like five times during the night wishing that this horrible dream would stop.
All right.
And then it would begin again.
Right. Okay.
All right. Time to bring on my friend, my correspondent, Roy. Roy, are you on the air?
I am, Derek.
Hey, good to hear from you. Oh, how are you today?
Yeah, well, that sounds like some strange dreams there.
I know. You know those fever dreams. It's actually a word, isn't it, in English? You had a fever dream.
Yeah, I think it is, or at least an expression. I know, you ever hear the thing, you eat pizza or Italian food and you get strange dreams?
No, I never really noticed that. Yeah, I've heard about that, but I've never really noticed it myself. My dreams are normally very placid.
I'm a believer in that.
Not much happens in my dreams. Normally, when I have them, it's just not much happening. But all night I was chasing flying furniture around this, like, three-dimensional anti-gravity world where all the furniture was mixing together and it was all chaotic and it was breaking when it hit it and forming into these big things, and it was everybody was trying to get it because they had to make their living by capturing the furniture. It was very strange.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always noticed that your dreams are always, like, terribly important and interesting to yourself, and when you try to tell them to somebody else, they're, like, bored out of their minds in 2 seconds.
Are you trying to tell me something about me telling you my dreams? I used to write them down. That was good. But dreams, I only tell it on the radio now so that somebody out there can psychoanalyze it and let me know what it means. You know, it's either Freudian or Jungian or something. You know, somebody can psychoanalyze my dreams and tell me what my subconscious is trying to say.
Right. Well, dreams are really important. You know, if you ever tried this, I read about this in a book a long time ago. Right as you go to sleep, that kind of that second or that few seconds between where you're conscious and you're slipped into sleep.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to tell yourself something like, I'm going to wake up in the morning refreshed and full of energy, whatever you do at that moment, generally your mind is tricked into believing it. Because when you're sleeping, your mind believes everything. That's why our dreams are weird. There's no objective criticism in your mind when you sleep. And if you tell yourself something at that moment, you will believe it.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So you're saying for people who wake up and because I know all these people who say, oh, they're so stressed out when they wake up in the morning because of their dreams and stuff. So are you saying that if you tell yourself to be calm, it'll work out? You can quiet your subconscious while you're asleep and wake up refreshed instead of stressed out?
Yeah. You know, something just occurred to me. You know how parents tell bedtime stories to their kids?
Yeah.
That's happening right as they're going to sleep. So that's probably a great way. You know, maybe we should all have somebody to tell bedtime stories to us, you know, right before we go to sleep.
I guess so. Maybe that's why a lot of people read books and stuff. But, you know, the traditional European fairy tales are kind of scary, though. You have people dying and Hansel and Gretel getting out into the woods and finding a witch and all this stuff. It's not very, very pleasant, all these fairy tale stories that we've told kids for hundreds of years.
Yeah, but they all teach an important lesson. They all have a moral
I think. Yeah, that's true. They teach an important lesson, but they don't. They don't make it calm. I don't know. Personally, I always have calm night's sleep, so I don't know what people are, why they have these stressful nights. I think of sleep as something very nice. You know, you go to bed, there you are, you wake up in the morning, and you're all ready and refreshed. But I know a lot of people that that's not true for them. So I don't know. Maybe we can help them out with this.
Yeah, well, maybe giving somebody something they can use to help them out.
What about you? Do you sleep well at night, or is that too personal of a question?
Yeah, I generally do sleep well. I actually remember my dreams a lot more than most people do. Remember my dreams a lot, and occasionally I'll actually sort out a problem in my dreams and wake up with an answer or something.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I do that a lot. I have dreams. I'm convinced. I think that the main dreams I have are of talking to people. And that must mean I'm very verbal or something. I'll have these long conversations in my dreams with people I know and people I've never met before. And I'll just sit there and talk with them, and I'll wake up and remember the conversation. That's got to be the main dream, the main type of dream that I have. It's never action dreams. It's never you know, you're late for a deadline or you're running down the hall or any of those dreams that people have. It's always just sitting on a couch somewhere talking to somebody. And I'll sit there and just have this long conversation about whatever, and then I wake up and remember what I talked about. So maybe I can work out my problems in the dreams. Or work out their problems for them and wake up.
Well,
and let them
know. I think dreams, you know, the reason I came across that item in that book about telling yourself something before you go to sleep is the book was actually on hypnosis. Mm-hmm. And that's what hypnosis is it's putting somebody to sleep while they're, you know, in a state of sleep while they're not completely, you know, while they're awake, essentially. And there's some techniques to doing it and stuff like that. But people think of hypnosis as some sort of voodoo mystical thing, but it actually is used, hypnotic techniques are used all the time. I mean, every time you step into a movie theater and you have that suspension of disbelief, you're essentially, that's like hypnosis, you know. Uh-huh. And that's why movies and music and things like that bypass your objective criticism are so powerful because they're essentially dreams. They go right to your soul. You don't filter them. They kind of bypass everything, music and movies. And so that's one of the reasons why the movie industry and television are so powerful is because it's like having a waking dream, but it's not just you, but tens of millions of people that are having the same dream. And, you know, if you imagine, like, if you could share your dream when you fall asleep at night with tens of millions of people, what kind of effect that would have. And that's one of the reasons why the arts are so powerful.
Do you think that's what arts are? They're just people's dreams put down on canvas or in movie theaters? Is it just their subconscious of what stuff that they think that they see in their mind that they're trying to show to us? I never thought about it that way. Is that
certainly
art?
Some movies, you know, you can definitely feel the director's angle in it, and you almost step out feeling like you've lived somebody else's dream for an hour or two or something like that.
Huh.
But even the ones that are a lot less, you know, you might have 30 people collaborating on a script or something like that. The point is the people, the audience, are actually experiencing that event like it really happened to them, but in a dreamlike quality, so that it speaks right to their soul. You know, it's not like when you're awake, you walk around and somebody tells you something, you take it with a grain of salt. When you actually go in and consciously suspend your disbelief in order to enjoy a movie, it's kind of feeding right into your subconscious there.
That's an interesting idea. I know that's probably why it is so important. And why so many people like us who are out there, we just despise Hollywood. I feel like Hollywood's so morally corrupt and awful. When I watch a movie, I'm sitting there analyzing. I'm trying to pick it apart and see what the message is and see what the intentions of the guy and his biases and all that. And I imagine most people who hate the media do that. And that's probably it makes it better. If you sit there and analyze the thing for the whole time, then you don't have this feeding into your subconscious. You're looking at it for what it is, which is a piece of art that has its own biases and intentions and personality to it, and you need to find out whether it's nasty biases.
Right, and you know, I mean, to me, that kind of kills the enjoyment of watching something. I'll do that if I have to watch it. I just don't watch much TV. And if I see a movie, it's generally one that somebody's recommended to me. And I still do keep an eye out for biases and stuff in there. But a lot of times people with our politics will look at the Hollywood elite, a lot of Jewish influence out there, and they'll say, well, these people are putting poisonous themes into these movies. And I think there might be a little bit of that, but really they're just giving you their perspective. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those people have a different culture than Christian America, and their perspective is different. I mean, because of historical perspective, they probably see white folks or you know, like they had bad experience with the Germans in World War II. They see us as not, you know, particularly good people. And so, you know, they might come across that way in their movies, and it's not because they consciously decide, well, we're going to go out and try to brainwash white people. It's just their perspective. You know, it's their dream. It's their vision. And because they have so much influence out there, their vision is becoming America's vision. You know, I mean, when we go into movie theaters, we always see, whether it's Star Wars, you have bad guys that look like SS troopers, or you have, you know, Schindler's List, or all these movies where Jews are victims, and that's how they see themselves, and so that's what they're, I mean, it would be weird if they would make a movie from our perspective. You know, it's just natural that they're going to make films from their own perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, you know, that's the bias of the media. I was watching some Oh, the Edge show on MSNBC last night that was lamenting the fact that conservatives owned all the talk radio channels. I don't know if this is true or not, but the Edge show was very upset, and they had Bill Press on, and they were so upset that talk radio is controlled by conservatives, and they went on and on and on about this. And you know, I'm just sitting there wondering why they don't talk about it. Yeah, the idea that these, you know, right wingers, and then beyond that, the traditional American perspectives are own the media. It's just not true. You know, if you whether you want to call it liberals or Jewish media or whatever, they're the ones who own the media. It's these anti-white factions, and nobody's willing to talk about it. So I thought it was very amusing when they're sitting there talking about it from this conservative point of view. It's some of those same things we would complain about when all these people monopolize the media, when they all own it. They're going to play it from their own perspective, and so if that's not in your interest, it's going to make you really mad when they use their control of the media to make movies and television shows that are against your interest, and then that's what people are going to watch as their entertainment, and it's not okay if you have people who are just totally opposed to you and your interest, and they're making all these movies, and they own all the studios. Yeah, that's not something that's okay. Here they were on the Ed show on MSNBC talking about how the government needed to step in and break up these conservative monopolies of talk radio, and they were so upset about this. They thought the idea that the way they perceived conservatives owning all the talk radio was a direct threat to their way of life, and that the only way they could do anything, that they could be happy, is if the government stepped in and broke up these monopolies, actually took away the position, took away the radio stations from these so-called conservative people and these conservative hosts, and forced them to air liberal opinions. And can you imagine the other way around? You have my show, I'm sitting around here saying, you know, the media is anti-white, and what I want is I want the government to step in and take these studios, take MSNBC and CNN from the owners, and give them to somebody who's pro-white so that he can air my perspectives. You know, you can imagine the outcry to that. And here they were on television talking about how liberal perspectives are not aired on talk radio, and the government needed to step in and create laws and actually take away these stations from these people. You know, it's amazing. It's double standard.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, talk radio is primarily AM talk radio. And this is a format that was basically largely abandoned. Because,
yeah, right-wingers
because
it
was just not seen as commercially viable. And so it's kind of a backwater of the media. And even today, how many people, when you go around town, are listening to AM radio? It's not really that many. I mean, it's mostly truck drivers, traveling salesmen, people who are in their cars a lot. They get bored with the music, so they'll flip over to the AM dial. This is just a backwater of media, and yet...
Ouch, man.
Go ahead.
Ouch. Go on.
It basically runs on a very thin budget, you know, AM radio does. It's not a really lucrative thing. There's not a lot of people investing in it. So it has to turn a profit. It's a very competitive format there. And so... The programs that have thrived have been conservative programs because that's where the audience is. They're talking to people who are listening, you know, and they have a choice. They can go and listen to FM radio. They can flip the dial to another station, whatever. There's no bottleneck there, or not as great a one. So that's why guys like Rush Limbaugh and some of these other conservative guys have thrived there, is because that's what the audience wanted to hear. With movies, there isn't really a lot of choice. I mean, there's so many movies that come out every year, and these movies are not really based on making money so much. Most of the movies don't make money. It's just generally investors that get suckered into funding these things, and a lot of these, you know, especially the artsy-fartsy movies that come out there are just so anti-white. These things lose money. I mean, millions of dollars every one of them. I don't know who the hell funds them. Mm. But it's not a competitive format like talk radio is. So at talk radio, it's amazing that they complain about it because they abandoned this medium, first of all. And then we stepped in and used it, and they have everything else, and they're complaining about talk radio.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. But it was very interesting to watch these liberals, the Ed Show and MSNBC, talking about how they were so concerned that these conservatives owned the AM radio stations and they were using their platform to spread these dangerous conservative perspectives. And so they actually needed the government to step in and regulate them, take away ownership. Bill Press advocated taking away these radio stations from these conservative owners and, well, I don't know, what, giving them to liberals or something. And they're passing laws that require the radio stations to have just as many liberal shows as they had conservative shows. That's Orwellian. That's awful. Hey, can you imagine that? And can you imagine the other way around? And I'm willing to say that the television channels are just entirely anti-white. They'll talk about illegal immigration, and they'll talk about the changing demographics is such a good thing. I watch CNN or anything else, and they're just without fail, they're always talking about how the changing demographics, which amount to genocide, and white people is a good thing, and they're looking for the heartwarming stories. Well, I'll come out and say, well, they're all owned by anti-white people, and so Congress needs to pass laws that take away these television stations from these people, and we need to give them pro-white people so that they'll have better perspectives on a couple of them, you know? Can you imagine? Yeah. What are they going to say? What's the Ed Show and Bill Press going to respond to that?
Oh, I don't know. You know, whenever a conservative makes a point on Bill O'Reilly's show or anywhere else, they'll just basically not respond and move on to the next topic. And that's the benefit of having the bully pulpit. That's why it's so good to own television stations and things like that.
Yeah, I'd love to own a television station.
The same thing from a conservative perspective. You know, if he gets a caller he doesn't like, he'll throw him on hold or mute his mic and then go to commercial. And that's the power of controlling media, is that you can avoid stories that aren't beneficial to your point of view. You can avoid perspectives that you don't like. And if somebody gives you one, you just ignore them and move on to the next topic.
Mm. That's an interesting thing. And it's the fact that media control amounts to control of the news is something that obviously these liberals know. And they just, because they control most of the media and these anti-white groups control most all of the media, the only times when they see something that they're opposed to are these conservative talk radio shows on the AM radio. That's the time when they go crazy. They want it all. They want to control the news, and they want to control people's perspectives, therefore. It's very kind of interesting. Whoever controls the media really does control the information.
Yeah, it's a control point. I was talking to a son of a very high-ranking politician that I accidentally ran into, and this guy was, you know, listening to my perspective, and he'd been in on the inside, met all the last recent presidents, had dinner with him quite a few times and everything. And he told me, you know, that he really was on the same page as I am as far as politics and on the same page as you are. But the point is he doesn't want to end up like Trafficant. You know, I mean, the media has that ability to control the discourse where a lot of these senators and congressmen really are on the same page as most white America. But they just can't open their mouths, or the media will destroy them, or you know, and give them the Trafficant treatment.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's definitely true. I wonder if people understand that the control that the media wedges, media levies over politicians. Any politician who comes out with a perspective, with a pro-white perspective, or you know, even an anti-Israel perspective, or something else that's politically incorrect, the media will come down on them. And beyond that, all the forces behind the scenes, the money. The funding and people funding of their opponents, and in the case of Trafficant, people like it, and people like himself, and be imprisoned, gone after by the legal system. Yeah, I don't know if people really understand the forces that are opposed to these people who go away from the political doctrine. If you're a congressman, if you make it all the way to being a congressman or a senator, you're not safe to say whatever you want. If you go around, you don't follow the political doctrines, you'll have the media come down on you, you'll lose your funding, and you'll lose your job as a congressman. It's not that they're out there and they have their perspective and they can speak how they want and all they have to answer to is their voters and their constituents. That's just not the way the United States works. They answer to a group of media elites and a group of political elites who follow a certain doctrine. And that doctrine, you know, for the perspective of this show, it's an anti-white doctrine. There are other aspects to it, but it's these people all have to follow it, or else they lose their jobs, and worse, they lose their livelihood. I wonder if people understand that. They may think that congressmen go out there, and I guess they know they have to have money, and they get elected, and there they go. But no, they don't have any type of freedom at all. They're always afraid. They're always afraid of what they say and how they're going to be taken and whether they're going to be supported by the elites.
Yeah, the media can take a couple shots at a congressman, and it can, you know, on free television, you know, a commentator or an anchor can say something against them, and they can't offset that with millions and millions of dollars of advertising because, you know, the anchor is the quote-unquote objective guy there, and when he says people, they're going to listen to a heck of a lot more than a politician's commercial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose that's true. We only have a couple of minutes left here, but what do you take from this media, the new stuff like MSNBC and Fox News that have a specific left-right agenda? They're unabashed. They say, well, you know, we're in support of the Democrats or we're in support of the Republicans, and they're on there and they act like they have some big political agenda they're going to push. Seems to be the turn in the cable news anyway. I guess broadcast news tries to maintain
most of the conservatives on there are just foils for the.
Well, yeah, I know that's true. But what do you make of this? Because they don't even act. They don't try to be objective. They don't pretend to be. Their gimmick and to get you to watch is that we're on the right or the left and we're gonna pick our side, and they go out and they attack the other side. I don't know what do you think the effect of that is.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's like watching a football game or something, or more like a fixed wrestling match, because whatever the outcome, it's not going to change the policies in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, it's kind of a distraction. It's a sideshow. And meanwhile, both sides are pursuing basically the same policies.
Yeah, I guess so. As I pointed out, the overarching issue, the one that you can tell in all the media, whether it be broadcast, who claim to be objective, or these cable news channels that choose their right-left agenda, they are all anti-white. They are all in favor of the changing demographics, which amounts to genocide of white people. They all follow that same doctrine, whether they be right-left or whether they be Republican or Democrat. That is the one thing that they all have in common. And so that's the one thing that you have to oppose them on, because you got to pick the thing that they're all afraid of, right?
That's right. That's right. You got to touch the stuff they won't touch.
Oh, an interesting thing. All right. Thanks, Roy, for coming on. We're going to have Craig Boedeker coming on in the show in a moment, talking about his movie, A Conversation About Race.
See you, Roy. Talk to you later, man.
Bye. Be back in a moment.
Derek Black, WPBR, 1340 AM.
All new WPBR, Lantana, Jupiter, and the Palm Beaches.
Well, the wife just left you and took the kids. There's creditors hounding you on the phone for overdue payments, and to top it off, you've just found out that your job has been outsourced to a packy named Aki. Sounds like it's Cooper's blend time. When your whole world is crashing down on you and there's nowhere to run, why not enjoy the ride with a cool tall glass of Cooper's Blend Bathtub Gin? With a unique mix of grain alcohol and pesticides, Cooper's Blend contains the smooth answers you need to get through life's rough patches.
Warning, habitual consumption of Cooper's Blend Bathtub Gin may result in birth defects, stomach ulcers, and hallucinations.
So the next time life throws a curve your way, sorry, baby, but this ticket's stamped one way for the Cooper's Blend train. Ah, Cooper's Blend Bathtub Gin. All aboard.
Top 15 station of Palm Beach County.
Welcome back to the Derek Black Show.
And welcome back to the program. This is the Derek Black Show on April Fool's Day. I don't know what we're going to do. We're going to pull any pranks or anything? Going to pull some kind of mischievous stuff in the studio?
You never know.
Is that the plan?
You never know. But,
is that the plan? I don't know. We've got to do something before we go. You know, go, I don't know. What do you do? You know, pour something, or I don't know. I don't know what you do. You know, pour orange juice in the water machine or something.
No, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. We'll hang a paint bottle over the door so when the owner opens it, it drops on his head, something like that.
Yeah, or we could announce that that Abe Boxman of the Anti-Defamation League has bought all rights to this program. How about that?
Well, that's true, though. That was last week.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, you cannot joke around, as we've tried. I try to tell you, you can't joke around on this show because people will are on the internet either, because people will take what you say absolutely literally.
I can't help that if they do that.
Somebody suggested last year that I should put, for April Fool, April 1st, I should put an announcement up that Abe Boxman of the Anti-Defamation League had bought Stormfront. And then they said, yeah, they'd be talking about that 5 years from now. they'd believe it, actually. Some people would. No. Cannot joke. You know, even the least subtle humor just doesn't work. On the net, and on this show, I hope it's a little different.
Well, I don't know. With the intonation of the voice, maybe you get a little something more, but I don't know. If people don't take a joke, it's not my responsibility.
I sometimes wonder how many people take our commercials, our spoof commercials, seriously. I bet there are some people out there that think there really is a Cooper's Bathtub Gin that's paying us to run their commercials, or that there's a John Law's Arms Supply. I bet there is. There are probably two or three people out there that take us dead seriously on everything we do, everything that's said on this program. What do you think?
I don't know. As I said before, it's not my responsibility if people take jokes literally.
Well, I know.
I have nothing I can do about that. So.
Well, in fact, I think on this station a few years ago, I think the Palm Beach Post or somebody wrote something about there was a host on this station that had some spoof commercials, not as good as ours, of course. But he had to stop running them because people really thought there were these businesses out there.
All right. It's time to bring on my guest for today. It's going to be a good interview. Craig Boedeker is the producer of the hit underground film, A Conversation About Race. This is the only pro-white film that I know of that's been accepted, at least by some, in the mainstream media. The Wall Street Journal called it fascinating. The film is even recommended by mainstream conservative publications like Human Events and The American Thinker. And if you haven't seen A Conversation About Race yet, do yourself a favor and visit Craig's website at aconversationaboutrace.com and buy a copy. Craig just released a follow-up DVD to A Conversation About Race called More of A Conversation About Race. He says, people tell me they want to see more of the behind-the-scenes process that he used to make it, as well as take a closer look at the interview subjects themselves and their amazing disconnects of logic. And so without any further ado, this is a very interesting documentary. It's one of the triumphs of the last few years, and I'm happy to bring on Craig Boedeker. Are you on the air?
Well, thanks so much for having me, Derek.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. This is going to be a good interview, and I encourage people on Tuesday to go and check this out on Google Video, which I have seen it there, and then I told them to watch it and then buy 10 copies and give them to all their friends.
Well, we sure do appreciate that. I think I should mention that I don't think it's on Google Video any longer.
Oh, I think people keep posting it, though. I've seen it go down
okay,
a couple
okay.
of times, and people put it up over and over again. You know, they want to spread the message. But the legality of that, well, I don't know. But it's not.
You know, that's a good point. When I made the film, I started thinking about, you know, what if people start, you know, showing it, you know, without my authority and without my authorization and things like that. And I realized at that point that that's kind of an uptown problem. I mean, if I have the problem where people want to see my movie without paying for it, well, at least they want to see it, right?
That's true. And every time I've checked, I've seen it on Google Videos and online on these different podcast websites that have show videos. And I've seen it there, and I don't know if there's anything you can do about that, because it is a viral video. It's just very interesting. I remember the first time I saw it, I was amazed by the thing. I posted clips of it on my website and had it on, and you know, everybody was amazed by the thing. I remember it was, like, what, 2 years ago, something like that, the first time I ever saw a piece of it.
Well, we sure like to hear that. Yeah, I think it's been out now for about a year and a half. We started shooting the original interviews about 2 years ago, and a lot of the feedback that I had gotten in the last year was that some people wanted to know, you know, how true was the documented? Did the subject really say this stuff, or were they tricked into saying this stuff or something like that? And so what I did is I came out with a bunch of additional footage that I didn't use in the original piece. So you can get a much more detailed look at each of the individual subjects, as well as a look at the process itself. I mean, if there are people in your audience that thought about, you know, trying to go out and make some films on their own and try to spread the message themselves, this would be a good piece to kind of look at and get some ideas of how a person actually puts this thing together and sets it up.
Yeah, so that's more of a conversation about race that they can find that about? That's that movie?
Yeah, and that's at the website, theconversationaboutrace.com, and I should mention that it's a brand new website. I think it officially opens up today. A guy named Jeffrey Addington did just a super job of putting it together for me. I've still got some fine-tuning and stuff to work out, but yeah, we're trying to bring the website into the 21st century and link it up with Facebook and the other social media and things like that.
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
I think
he
did a super job, so I would encourage people to, if you haven't been to the site, or even if you have in the past, check out the new conversationaboutrace.com. You can see excerpts from both films, and you can also buy both films as well.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It's a nice-looking website. So I think we should just go back to the beginning and let people know how this started. You know, what made you decide to create this movie? I understand that you were inspired by Obama's A Conversation About Race, the speech he made while he was running for president, and that's what inspired you to make this movie in the first place?
Well, exactly right. I saw a candidate, and this was before the November election of 08, Eric. So people in America, we weren't really sure what to think about Barack Obama. I think the conventional wisdom at the time was that Americans were not going to elect a black president. We were too racist. That was really the conventional wisdom at the time. And so when I heard this well-spoken black candidate stand up and for the first time, you know, say, and in his speech, I think he was actually defending the horrible comments that Reverend Wright made, but he gave a speech in Philadelphia, and he said, it's about time that we have a conversation about race. He said race is an issue that we can no longer afford to ignore.
But what did Obama say about race in his conversation?
The truth is, he never had the conversation. You know, the media gives him such a pass that they all credit him for initiating this dialogue, but you know, without breaking my arm, patting myself on the back, as far as I know, I'm the only guy who's actually created this dialogue and tried to put it on film.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually what you did. You had a real conversation. You went out and found people in the classified ads. You put out an ad for it. Let me know the process, how you began making this movie once you decided you were going to make a documentary that was a real, literal conversation about race. What was the process?
Sure. The first step was just trying to get an idea of what I wanted to accomplish with it, and I realized interviews would be the easiest way, and so I ran an ad in Craigslist for interview subjects on the topic of ending racism now. And I hired a couple of temps and some stuff to make the phone calls and set up some appointments. I went to a real nice hotel downtown Denver and rented a real fancy meeting room to lend a little credibility, you know, to the subjects. And then I never actually met any of the subjects until the interviews themselves. I had the temps and the production assistants deal with that. So I had a nice, fresh place to start. They didn't have any preconceived ideas of who I was. I typed up a bunch of typical generic questions that people would expect to get asked in an interview like this in today's atmosphere of white people are racist and it's a problem that has to be solved. And so I typed up a bunch of sample questions along with the actual questions that I used and let the people actually peruse those before they were interviewed. But anyway, so we had a shooting day for the indoor interviews. That was first. We set up the hotel in the early morning, and actually it ended up being about an 18-hour day for me. We shot all of the indoor interviews in one day, and I didn't even take a break. Actually, I think they convinced me to take 20 minutes for lunch, but I was just so hyped on what I was doing that I wasn't even hungry. I was just really into doing these interviews. Mm-hmm. And so the first step was, do the interviews. Find out the contradictions and the fact that nobody has even an inkling of what this word means, racist, but yet so many people use it all the time.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What were the questions that you finally put to the people that appear in the movie?
I think in the sequence, the most important ones were, number one, do you see racism in your daily life? Mm-hmm. And everybody does.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Then the next question was, what is racism? Please define it. And that's where the first problem starts. people tell me they see it all the time, but yet when you ask them to define it, it's or else it comes into something so generic like, oh, racist is a person who believes such and such.
Mm.
And it's like, okay, let me see if I get this straight. You should treat people differently because of their beliefs. Is that how it works in America?
Mm.
If someone believes something, then they should be, you know, afforded a different set of rights than someone who doesn't believe this. It's such a convoluted mess that I thought, well, rather than try to, you know, clear it up, I'll just highlight the convolutions themselves.
Mm-hmm. And it really comes out interesting. What was your... The movie, you talk to people, and everybody's just amazed at the disconnect of logic that these interviewees had. We talked about on Tuesday the fact I called them idiots, and I was corrected because they're not really idiots. They're educated people. In most of the cases, they seem like they consider themselves reasonable. They probably hold down jobs. They probably live normal lives. And yet when they're asked these questions, they use no rationality. In the rest of their life, they presumably use rationality. But here, they cannot, and they repeat stuff that they've heard, things that they think are the right thing to say, and it's not rational, it's not logical. What was the most surprising part of their answers to you?
Well, I'm not sure if I'd call it surprising because I kind of predicted it was going to happen, but I guess that's the part that's most revealing in the film is that the typical response to the question posed of why do white students score better on standardized tests than black students?
Mm-hmm.
And the standard answer, and I'm sure you know this, Derek, the standard answer that most Americans answer with is cultural bias.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason whites outscore blacks is because there's this phenomenon of cultural bias. We're not even aware of it. It's just something that we do. We can't even, you know, we can't even stop it. It's just part of our racist heritage or nature. But then when you ask, okay, well, so these tests are written by whites and they're culturally biased, so that's why the whites score higher. Well, then why is it, if they're actually designed for whites because of our bias, why is it that Asian students actually outperform us?
Mm.
And then that's when they start stuttering, and that's when they actually have to start thinking about it for the first time because they just told me that the tests were designed specifically for white people. And that's why whites outscore certain others. But when others outscore whites, well, then they don't have to get into theories of supremacy and bias. That's just the way it works.
Mm. It's just smarter people, I suppose.
Yeah.
That was the interesting thing. It always is. When I had Jared Taylor on the program, I had him on the other day, and you know, we were talking about all the sensitive issue of racial crime and how non-whites tend to commit such enormous, such a much higher per capita crime than whites, but he always comes to the fact that Asians, East Asians, commit much lower crimes than whites, and so, you know, we are, you know, this is not white supremacy, don't worry.
And, you know, I have such a great deal of respect for Mr. Taylor, and I wish that I had the air of sophistication that he does and the calmness that he does. I don't. I just, this stuff works me up sometimes, and I get upset like most people about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I see, I mean, especially these network, I mean, I heard you, with your last guest, you mentioned some of these network news organizations, and especially I got to say this Chris Matthews and this MSNBC and this constant anti-white hammering, this notion that a group of Tea Partiers, because they're mainly white, is inherently evil, but yet he never seems to bring up, you know, the group of taxpayers who are inherently white and what exactly is evil about us.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about the health care bill too. The people who are paying for it are going to be disproportionately white. But, you know, this isn't a racial issue. It actually cheered me up when Rush Limbaugh called it a new civil rights bill. Because for one thing, it's Rush Limbaugh implying that he didn't think the original civil rights bills were good, you know, which is a very controversial thing to say. And second of all, it brings the fact that this health care bill really is racially designed. It's not intended for poverty or anything. It's a racial bill. It's intended in the socialist idea to try to level out the playing field. From these,
well, of course,
these two advanced,
where,
these
where
whites.
Where are the people searching for disparate impacts now?
What did you say?
You know, everyone's crying about disparate impact. Oh, my God, the blacks are being disparately impacted. And it's like, well, aren't whites being disparately impacted here? I mean, isn't the fact that whites pay the taxes and they're going to go up, you know, just astronomically? But nobody seems to care about that, you know, that
exactly.
thing that affects white people.
Hey, hey Greg, I just had a caller who asked you to speak slower.
I'm sorry. You know, I have a little note telling myself to do that, and sometimes I get so animated that I forget. So
yeah, as Sam Dixon says, we're Southerners, and we can't think that fast.
Yeah, there's another guy I have a great deal of respect for, Mr. Dixon. I wish I could spend a couple hours just talking with him. His mind is like a computer. It's like he's got all these facts in there. I have nothing but admiration for Mr. Dixon.
So I think that the real interesting thing about your movie comes down, well, in the response of the interviewees, is the fact that they have this disconnect. The main disconnect of logic is that they will not see how whites are disparately affected by these bias, by these programs in the United States. They are affected negatively, and yet these people understand that, and yet they don't see that as a bad thing. They don't see affirmative action in these programs that are biased against whites as bad things, and they claim that they're reasonable because of racism, because of endemic racism, which has caused undue hardship to the non-white population of the world and of America specifically. And so anything bad that's done to whites to level the playing field or take from whites and hurt them academically or in their jobs or anywhere else, with the health care bill being one aspect of that, they don't seem to think that that's a bad thing. They don't seem to think that this bias and this programs that hurt whites are bad things.
And that extends itself also to what you mentioned earlier about the crime that's committed against whites.
Mm.
The fact that these so-called, you know, the racist behaviors that whites seem to display, but yet no one can seem to quantify. These are bad things, but yet the obvious assaults and robberies and rapes and tortures and murders that are done to whites by other races each year, these are just tolerated. Well, you know, even though it's, what's the rape difference, 37,000 to none or something like that, but that's not anything against whites. We're just supposed to, you know, keep a stiff upper lip.
Mm-hmm. Which is rapes. I imagine are considered by just about everybody to be the most violent, the most horrific sort of violent crimes. And when it comes down to interracial rapes, statistically zero whites raping non-whites, raping blacks. And so, you know, these crime statistics, I think they're very sensitive because it makes it sound like you're saying just all these awful things about people. But when it comes down to it, it's the violent crimes committed in this country are not committed by whites against other people. They're committed against whites, and yet whites are supposed to just accept that. I want to talk about now what happened after you made your movie. And what was your response? Because the Wall Street Journal commented on your movie, and you've become a star in the United States now. So what happened after you produced it?
That may be a bit of an overstatement, but the movie has gotten some success, and I really think, like I said, I don't want to break my arm patting myself on the back here, but because I think it was the right film at the right time. I was worried when I was making the film that someone else might be making the exact same film. I really felt some urgency, like I can't be the only guy aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
But so to answer your question, as far as after the fact, it did take a little while to pick up a little steam. I finally got invited to a local radio show. Mike Rosen, a local Denver radio personality, he's got a huge audience all over the western United States, one of these super-powered AM stations, and he was gracious enough to have me on the show twice. And from there, I picked up, I think, an endorsement from Ross Kaminsky of the Denver Post. And so it started picking up there. In fact, I never heard any negative feedback about the film at all, except for, comments made in, absurd, websites from people who have not seen the film. Everyone who's seen the film has either, said good things about it or said nothing about it. Luckily, a black PhD, a member of the National Council of the Humanities, Dr. Carol Swain, endorsed the film. She said anyone who studies race and ethnicity has to see this movie. And that's how the Wall Street Journal picked it up. The Southern Poverty Law Center, your good friends, Derek, said that I was a hateful person for making this film, and the film was no good, blah, blah, blah. And luckily, the Wall Street Journal came on and defended Carol Swain's endorsement of the film.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What did you do to spread the film, to actually get people to watch it? Did you have screenings in actual theaters? Did you
No, I wish
sell
I could.
The DVD,
it's so controversial that, one guy talked to me about theaters somewhat. It never worked out. I had Denver PBS, local public television, can I say the term, jerk me around for 4 months promising me they were going to air it. It was so good. It was so controversial. They couldn't wait to air it. And and luckily, I've been in business to know a slow play when I see one. And it was really crude the way they treated me, promising me to show this film. And at the end, saying, you know, on second thought, we're not going to show it after all. You know, hope you're not too upset. But as far as to answer your question about marketing the film, you know, just honestly getting on the phone and sending a lot of emails and you know, doing the non-glamorous stuff that a producer has to do to get people to see the film.
Mm. Well, yeah, that's a lot of work, and I suppose the Internet's helped a lot.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't do it without, you know, I posted the excerpts on YouTube and on Facebook, and, of course, other people have picked it up. And, you know, I've had people even take my avatar and use it as their own. Now, it's kind of, I guess that's pretty flattering, I guess, actually.
No, yeah, well, there you go. Well, yeah, it's true, you are kind of a star. When I first saw the movie, I didn't know who you were. I was like, wow, it's a great movie. Where'd this come from? And I think that was generally the reaction around the country. All these people who see it and who have given you good reviews, their general reaction is, where would this kind of this effort come from? So I want to ask you that. Where did that build up from? I know you were inspired by Obama's speech, which did not have a conversation about race, did not answer anything. It was just political posturing. It didn't talk about the real racial issues in this country, and you were inspired by that. But where did this come from, though, the build-up to produce such a movie?
Well, I guess it's just part of my nature. I'm kind of keyed. I've traveled a lot. I've been fortunate that I lived outside of the country. I lived in Hawaii for about 10 years, and using Hawaii as a base, I got to travel and see a lot of different parts of the world. So I've been pretty fortunate in my travel experiences. And I just learned that the stuff that they taught us, especially that little, if you remember at the end of the film, I go into my history of my fifth grade class and how they indoctrinated us on racism. And then so I took the knowledge that I had of racism that I was given in my fifth grade class and I learned in America and started traveling and I realized that what they taught us just wasn't true. I mean, if white people treat other races bad, well, actually other races treat other races bad too. It's just humanity.
That's interesting.
It seems to be getting more and more prevalent. And when I lived in Hawaii, too, being a minority as a white person, I got to experience life as a minority. I spent a little time in the American South as well, and as a minority in an area where I was not the majority. And so it was real educational for me to see the contrast between what the TV world and what the governed media say the world is like and what the real world is like, because it's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So one question, I think. Do you think that your group of people, this is the final one, do you think the group of people that you found are prevalent, or do you think they're common, and that is the rule in terms of people in America who you'll find, who at least in the cities, who you ask them about race, and they just cannot rationally discuss it? They'll tell you racism is endemic. Racism exists.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's the rule?
The rule and not the exception. Maybe not 100%, but pretty close to it. I mean, some of the people that didn't make the interview were a little more level-headed, but never really, you know, I'd say most people are not fair. The only people that I meet that are actually fair and open-minded on the subject, well, I shouldn't say only, but for the most part are white nationalists.
Mm. Yeah, people like this show that are don't care about what happens to us.
I think that there's, I mean, when you mentioned that you felt that I had come out of nowhere, the truth is, I think that's the only reason I got the press that I did.
Mm-hmm.
If I had had a background as a white advocate or something like that, I don't think anybody would have given me the time of day.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're probably right there.
Because I'm coming out of nowhere here in Colorado, and people say, wow, this is kind of a fresh outlook, and I'm going to give it to a local radio personality. And when I made the film, I sent it to Rush, I sent it to Fox, I sent it to everybody I could possibly think of, you know, Ann Coulter and the conservatives and over on the left side, too, and didn't get much of a response. You know, and that's why I had to keep working it and keep working it, and eventually, you know, knock on wood, it panned out the way it did. And they're still selling, knock on wood.
Yeah, those right-wing, I guess left-wing media personalities, they didn't respond to you?
No, and you know I'm not sure about, you know, using the terms right wing and left wing for TV.
Well, I mean like Rush
kind of,
and these people.
It's kind of the TV right and the TV left.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
like
we talked about
world,
earlier,
like the
they're spoils, but they're just foils. But they have their role to play.
Right.
They have their character persona, and so Rush didn't respond. Ann Coulter, who on some issues of race sometimes can sound very reasonable, she didn't respond at all.
This goes back like almost 2 years ago, and I think it's pretty standard. I don't blame any of them. I'm a businessman myself, and I know that these people and their companies, they spend a great deal of money and time developing their audience, And they've got this asset, and it's not just something that they're just going to give away to any, you know, any filmmaker. Hey, let me have access to your audience. I think the answer is, well, why don't you go build your own audience?
Man, I guess that's what you've done, huh?
Well, I'm working on it anyway.
All right. So that's a conversationaboutrace.com. There's a memorable title for a web domain. Anybody can find that, and they go online. And at last I checked, it was on Google Videos. But, you know, if it goes down, it'll be back in 3 days. So you can check it out. But they buy copies because that's the value of the movie. It's something I talked on Tuesday. I said that if they have, like, a liberal sister-in-law or something, and she's just, oh, she thinks you're a racist. Well, you give her a copy of the movie, and it's an introduction for her, and it's something that'll really spark some interesting thoughts, and all of a sudden you'll have a sister-in-law who's a little bit more rational. And that's the real value of this movie. You get a copy of it, and you show it to people. If you're already in agreement with the things, and you're like me, and you're listening to this show out there, and you're thinking, well, you know, I agree with him. Well, you watch the movie and give it to people, and you can it'll help you to spread the message. It'll help you to begin that conversation with other people that you know.
And that was kind of the intention behind it, was it not so much to preach to the choir. That some of the best reviews I get are from people, you know, I shouldn't say, well, academics are not the best, but high IQ people seem to like this movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because it's very high tone, it appeals to logic and rationality. And that's a very strong argument for this case, for the situation in America today, because it's irrational. The anti-white programs in America that everybody accepts, it's just because of endemic racism, are irrational. And so if you appeal to logic, then I guess the high IQ people who like logic, we can respond to it.
And I'll let you say it better than I can.
All right. Well, thanks, Craig, for coming on the program today. I really appreciate it, and I hope that everybody goes out and buys 10 copies.
Well, thanks so much, Derek, for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks for coming on today. That's Craig Boedeker with A Conversation About Race, an amazing documentary. Go to aconversationaboutrace.com. You can check it out, see clips, and read about it, and read the reviews, and find out about this very interesting documentary and its impact on the world today. All right, we'll be back with the final half hour of the Derek Black Show on 1340 AM in just a moment with the final talk. See you then.
Sure to get scurvy and various other fascinating skin conditions, just like a real pirate. Arr! But that's not all, ye stinky little landlubbers. There's also a buried treasure in each box of Captain Legs pirate food.
Oh, wow! Awesome, sis! Look! I got an eye patch! What did you get?
Oh, I got a pair of skivvies. And judging by their condition, it looks like the pirate who wore them got too much vitamin C.
Neato! I got a pirate's hook! What did you get, sis?
Oh, I got his hand.
Arr, so listen up, ye bratty scallywags. Best tell your mom to buy ye some of me cereal or I'll slit your tiny little throats. Arr, I was just fooling. So the next time you're pining for a treat that's not good to eat, make sure you say,
come on, Mom, buy me some Captain Legs pirate food, or I'll tell Dad about your daytime drinking.
Arr, Captain Legs pirate food, it's a mutiny in your mouth.
Captain Legs pirate food, please eat responsibly.
Talk 1340, the talk station of Palm Beach County.
Welcome back. to the Derek Black Show.
And welcome back to the program. And now we had a caller over the break who asked for the name of the movie, and the name of the movie is in fact a conversation about race. I can understand this; it sounds like a description, but no, that's the name of the documentary, A Conversation About Race. And you can find the documentary's website on aconversationaboutrace.com. That was our guest in the last half hour, Craig Boedeker, who is the producer and director and editor of a very interesting documentary, very well made, very very enlightening, very rational, and a very high tone. And it serves a important role in the United States today because it's something that you can show to people. You can screen it. You could have a big public screening. If you have some town and you have a big projector on the wall somewhere downtown, you know your little town, you could show it to people, and it would create a lot of good conversations among the people who saw it. It's that kind of movie. You could show it anywhere. You just take it, hand it out to people, and it's based in logic and rationality, and it's based in fact and, well, these disconnects of logic that people tend to have in this age of political correctness and racial orthodoxy. So it's A Conversation About Race is the name of the movie, and you can check it out online. Well, what did you think about that interview, huh?
I thought that was a great interview by Craig. The movie, of course, which I saw for the first time last summer at the Council of Conservative Citizens National Conference. I think it's really effective because it really highlights the fuzzy, muddled thinking of which goes for the established political thought nowadays on race. It highlights the hypocrisy and the fact that no one is really these people that just parrot this multi-culti ideology have never really thought about it. They don't, and the first two questions, of course, which he asked some of his participants was, have you experienced racism in your everyday life? And everybody said, oh, yeah, all over, everything.
And then can you define what that experience was? And they said, well, you know, one time a guy looked at me weird.
Yeah, define racism. Do you know how would you define racism that you've experienced every day in your life? And they don't really know. They haven't really thought about that. But they've been told all their lives that racism is endemic throughout our society and has to be combated.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny stories. A lot of it, it seems like they pulled them out of heart-wrenching Hollywood movies. This one guy tells a story about how he had always been taught not to share a cup with a black man, and then he was in Vietnam, and he shared his canteen with a black man, and he realized that point, that's how he proved he wasn't racist, which sounds like a nice heart-wrenching Hollywood movie, but in reality, I don't know exactly what this means, that you shared your canteen with a black man. You know, that's the basis of racism? That's the big problem that people are talking about?
Right. Well, that story just gives you the warm fuzzies
It's like he pulled it from a Steven Spielberg movie or something. Where do people get this stuff from?
Right. Well, it's a great film, so everybody should go see it, buy a copy, buy 10 copies for your mother. it's tremendous, particularly for those, and it does appeal to the to those who are somewhat independent thinkers, the more intellectual types who can think for themselves, but who have never really thought about all of this because they've never really been exposed to the other side, to the other point of view, because the media, the national media, and the educational establishment very carefully censors any opposing point of view. And of course, Craig pointed out the worst of the national media, which we watch all the time.
We. I had the flu, and I was sitting there in the MSNBC, and the Ed Show were disorienting me.
The Ed Show. I can't stand Ed. I normally turn that off. He's the worst of all.
I was sitting there with feverish shakes watching the Ed Show complain with Bill Press about how conservatives own the AM radio talk show, and we need Congress to pass laws to get this monopoly broken. I got dizzy watching it.
Yes, well, this is MSNBC, for those of you who don't experience that very much. Of course, their biggest star is Keith Olbermann, He draws their biggest ratings, and of course he is just intolerable, insufferable. He is so anti-white. He cannot stand white people. He cannot stand tea parties because they're mostly white. He's just intolerable, as of course Chris Matthews is the other one, and then of course Rachel Maddow that comes on after them, the out of the closet lesbian. Who reflects a similar philosophy. They've got a whole lineup of really obnoxious liberals, but we watch it because I can't stand Fox or and CNN. CNN tries to take the middle of the road, but and like I commented on this at the first part of the program. I don't know if you heard it, but Anderson Cooper was actually taking an objective point of view, which is the first time I've heard this from the national media about this so-called militia, Christian extremist militia in Michigan. He was actually pointing out with the reporter who had been covering it that this appeared to just all be talk. These people had no, unlike the media had been portraying it, the government and the media, which parrots whatever the government says, has been portraying this as some sort of terrible threat, overshadowing everything else, all the other murders and kidnappings and rapes that are going on every day in the country, much of it by drug gangs. Well, that's not important to the media, but this is being portrayed as some sort of terrible threat that was fortunately averted, when in fact these people didn't have the capability to do anything. All they were doing was talking, and we don't even know what they said. The informant probably was leading the conversation. They might have just been humoring him, and that's typical, very typical, when you have contract informants whose mission is to get some arrest. The informant will lead the conversation, and sometimes, in a relaxed atmosphere, they'll kind of go along with it or humor him, or maybe not even. Sometimes they just not objecting to what he's saying is enough to get you arrested. You have to be really careful about talk, folks, because these people have been charged with seditious conspiracy. Sedition is a category of speech, which was pretty much declared unconstitutional, even though the laws are still on the books, a category of speech in which you oppose the authority of the government.
This sedition, when they talk about sedition, is this related to the 1790s James Monroe, original second president laws, the so controversial on America's infancy, or is this something much later? It's totally unrelated. When you talk about sedition.
The current law came later. But the category sedition is a concept that's been around since for a long time. The British used to have sedition laws, in which opposing just speech opposing the government was considered sedition, opposing the authority of the government. Well, now they've changed the they're taking a different approach. So the seditious conspiracy has rarely been used. It was used in 86, with the Fort Smith sedition trial.
Why do they pull up sedition as a crime?
Because they want to criminalize speech. But what they're doing here is they're saying that the speech led to illegal action. So that they kind of get around some earlier Supreme Court rulings, which held that the idea that sedition was constitutionally protected speech. You could oppose the government.
Well,
you know,
the definition of sedition is speech against the government.
I know we had all these left-wingers, all these radical left-wingers who had names like Hoffman and Rubin and Weinstein and what's the other one that's in the news now, Azinsky, anyway, who were advocating the overthrow of the United States government in the 60s and 70s, early 70s. And, of course, the courts pretty much protected them. They considered that constitutionally protected speech, even though there was a lot of violence associated with it. There were bombings the number of bombings that some of these people were associated with. But they would never have been charged with sedition or seditious conspiracy. But the government's trying to bring this back. And, of course, in the 80s, they had the Fort Smith sedition trial, in which everybody was acquitted. These were people associated with the Order, which was a pro-white guerrilla army, I guess. They were involved in a lot of things, like armored car robberies to fund their activities and all of this. But there were a lot of other people that were indicted for seditious conspiracy that didn't have anything to do with that. Nothing at all. But
I don't understand what the reason is to choose sedition instead of choosing bank robberies or planning to kill cops or something. Why choose speech against the government as the crime?
Because they didn't do anything. They didn't, in the Fort Smith sedition trial, most of these people weren't involved in armored car robberies anything like that.
So that's what I would think. So they're choosing sedition because there's not another crime. There's not a real crime.
But they're saying there were crimes. There were clearly violations of the law, and you rob
armored
cars.
Why not choose those, though? And what about
because they weren't involved in them. These people.
What about this Christian militia group? Why are they charged with sedition?
Because they didn't do anything illegal either. All they did was talk. Now, according to the government, what made it illegal, what made the talk illegal, was an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. They downloaded information on how to make a i.e. improvised explosive device off the internet. Now, that wouldn't normally be illegal, too, but then they supposedly they asked this informant to build them an explosive device. Mm. But they never had explosives. They say they have chemicals that could make explosives. Normally, when they say that means they have household chemicals, maybe fertilizer, something like that, laying around. They didn't have explosives, couldn't have made explosives. They had no ability to, and the firearms they had were all legal.
Mm-hmm.
They had and then they charged them with carrying a firearm during the commission of a felony, which was this talk. Felony was seditious conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
So they stack up these charges. But like I said, we started out on this because of CNN. Anderson Cooper actually, for the first time I ever heard any mainstream news say that, well, maybe there's really nothing to this, that it was just talk. And that frequently we find out later, after all the initial publicity, that it was the informant who was directing all of this to begin with. And I just about would bet the farm that it was the informant's idea. In fact, they may not have participated at all. They may have just gone along, just humored the guy. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, if some guy, if you're in a situation like that and you don't dress the guy down when he suggests something illegal, you can get into trouble yourself. I mean, you can't just be passive about it. You have to tell them you don't want anything to do with that because they're recording you. And if you're equivocal about it, we know one individual in Illinois, Matt Hale, who's serving 40 years now because a contract informant, I think it was paid $50,000 to set him up, asked if he should kill this federal judge, woman Lefkow, the federal judge in Illinois who he'd had a problem with on a trademark dispute. And he gave an equivocal answer. That's all he did. He said, no, I want to stay completely legal. Whatever you do is your business. Basically, is what he said. That got Matt Hale 40 years in prison for soliciting the murder of a federal judge. And this was all he said. He gave an equivocal answer. When he should have dressed the guy down, said, absolutely not. But he didn't say that. He said, as you know, I want to stay completely legal. Whatever you do is your business. That got Matt Hale 40 years in prison. Well, I suspect this is a similar situation. The informant was leading the conversation because the government wants to demonize all opposition to its policies. It wants to demonize, quote, Christian extremist. That's the word the media has been using, Christian extremist. And this is a good way to do it. It got a lot of publicity, and it got a lot of bad publicity for, quote, Christian extremist.
See, that's what I would focus on here, the fact that the media has made such a big deal out of the huge threat from the Christian militia groups of this country. I think any reasonable person knows that the Christian militia groups of the country aren't going to bring us down and destroy the country, and that's not where all your danger is coming from. The danger comes from much more mundane things. But the idea that the mass media wants to portray the Christian militia group as the great violent anti-government, anti-American threat, while liberal media, they're the ones who are really pro-American, it's absurd. But I wonder why they decide they're going to do that right now, though. Is there any particular reason that the mass media is motivated now to attack the Christian militia groups of this country and portray them as extremely violent?
The mass media is very concerned about a popular uprising against the government's policies on immigration and, of course, on increasing totalitarian government. They're very concerned about the Tea Parties. the Tea Partiers are really maligned on most media, particularly MSNBC. They're the worst, of course. They're really maligned. And, you know, anything, if somebody yells a racial epithet in a crowd, at a Tea Party crowd, one person yells a racial epithet at John Lewis, the congressman, boy, it's national news for days. And, of course, when you have a crowd, it'll probably say, you know, get an individual to do anything. In fact, you can even have plant people in crowds. These aren't well organized. But, you know, there's a lot of anger, so it might have been a legitimate angry guy, but who knows what it was. But it wasn't national news for days. Somebody at a Tea Party yelled a racial epithet. I mean, it's absurd. We have, again, people murdered, raped, kidnapped by Mexican drug gangs, other drug gangs. Here in Lake Worth, we have Haitian drug gangs. But nobody's worried about that. The media's not worried about it. It's not news.
Yeah, that's what I say. The real threats that people face, and the violent threats, are more mundane stuff. It's just everyday life. It's the idea, the fanciful idea that Christian militia groups are gearing up to take on the government. It's just not, it's fantastic. It's not actually going to happen. The idea that the media is portraying, the way they're portraying it, is just not realistic. And it's interesting that they just have a vitriol against these Christian militia. When it comes down to not Christian militia groups, they have a vitriol against just mainstream Christian people. You know, when it comes down to white Christian Americans living places, they have a fear and a vitriol against them. And so by talking about the Christian militia threat, they're able to attack those people.
Well, they're doing a good job, because most Americans, when they hear this news, they think a terrible threat has been averted, that these people were going to murder hundreds of police officers. I mean, that sounds pretty bad, you know, but when it comes down to it, and a few reporters, fortunately, are actually pointing this out, there's nothing happening there. It was all banter, talk.
Well, you sound like a big supporter of Anderson Cooper. I'm impressed.
I'm more impressed with Anderson. I didn't think he was all, I didn't think much of him before last night, but he is a little more objective than the rest of them. Certainly better than the MSNBC crowd, who go on and on and on about, and they trot out Mark Potok, and boy, that guy must be really busy. He's on every one of these. Every single news outlet runs Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the guy that sues not only pro-white organizations, but anybody opposing illegal immigrants is a target of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Potok, his whole gang, Levin, Byrick, who's the other one, Cohen, mm-hmm. You know, they're the leaders of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Morris Seligman Dees, who's not Jewish, apparently. He was named after one, his middle age says. But he's no longer very prominent in that organization, even though he founded it. Apparently he's raised millions of dollars by milking his liberal supporters, by scaring them about hate over the years. He's almost seems like he's retired now. But Potok is their spokesman. He's the director of the SPLC, and Cohen and Levin, one of them CEO. I don't remember what all they are. One of them CEO. And, of course, Byrick is the one that writes many of their nasty little stories about people like you and me. But anyway, that's what we're up against. I pointed this out on the last show. You know, the Southern Poverty Law Center gets all of this publicity. Huge amount. I mean, the media, and they're treated with such deference. They're treated like authorities, even though they have an agenda, a very anti-white agenda, very pro-third world immigration.
Well, that comes
agenda.
Down to the fact that the media is extremely biased.
Well, they certainly are. Certainly are, but they're trotted on as experts about hate and about militia groups. But despite all of this publicity, their website, splcenter.org, gets a fraction of the traffic of Stormfront. Now, Stormfront doesn't get much publicity. I mean, it gets some, but I'm not on all of these television networks every day. In fact, I usually decline interviews, but we get very little publicity on the mainstream media, yet we get a lot more traffic. Now, why is that? This is according to Alexa, independent these companies, services that rate, that track traffic on various different websites. Alexa is one of them, Compete's one of them, Quantcast is one of them. Anybody can check this. I really don't understand it. I'm actually a little bit baffled by that. How come nobody cares about what the SPLC has to say on their website, or not too many people? How come so many more people seek us out than look at to them? Well, that's a rhetorical question, isn't it? They're looking for real answers. They're not looking for the same old liberal claptrap that they hear on the media all the time.
Hmm. All right, hey, we've got a caller. I only got 5 minutes left on the program, but it's got a caller from Port Charlotte over there on the west coast of Florida. Hey, Marty, are you on the air?
Yeah, hi, Derek.
Hi, how are you today?
Derek, I was wondering, do you think that Obama is going to get the amnesty bill passed?
I really don't know. It's interesting that that's the next thing that they're going to tackle. Now, with this health care bill apparently behind them, the amnesty bill is what they're going to go after immediately. So I don't know how it's going to be. I imagine there's going to be a lot more reaction to it than the health care bill had, though. You remember the McCain amnesty bill. That was some of the most reaction, the largest mass reaction in America that I've seen for any bill. You had millions of people who were just up in arms about the amnesty bill that McCain and Bush were, and McCain and Kennedy and Bush were all together in trying to pass. And that was only a few years ago. So now I think things have changed to where people will be even more upset about it. And particularly with Obama, you'll have the right and these Tea Party people mobilizing against it. And so there's nothing they can do except look at the facts of illegal immigration. They're gonna have to oppose it. And I don't know if he'll get it passed or not, though.
Do you think it's more of a bipartisan issue, though? Like, would Democrats and Republicans oppose it?
Well, I don't think Democrats aren't going to oppose it. I wonder if the Republicans are going to oppose it. You know, what's interesting about it is no matter what they want to say, illegal immigration is not just a legal issue. It's a racial issue because those are the people who are coming here, and it's changing the demographics of all these states. And it's not just a legal issue as much as these people, even Republicans, want to pretend it is. So if Republicans are going to vote not even one person for Obama's proposed amnesty legislation once it comes around, they're going to be making a pretty strong statement as a party, much more strong than opposing the health care bill. If you oppose the health care bill, that's just this complicated health care and insurance stuff. If you're opposed to that, it's a lot easier. For all Republicans to be opposed to the illegal amnesty bill, well, yeah, it's going to be a much stronger statement as a party. I think it'll probably change them. Change the way the Republican Party exists in the United States, if that's what happens. And, of course, there's the other idea that maybe the Republicans will support it. Well, can you imagine that? The health care bill didn't get one Republican vote, but imagine the amnesty bill. Republicans make such a statement about how they're going to get the Latino vote. They never do, but they claim that they want it. They can get it. You know, they can steal it away from the Democrats, which is not going to happen. And so, well, I wouldn't be surprised if you have a few who are voting for the amnesty bill. And that would be interesting, too.
Yeah, but it's like right now there's 30 million illegal aliens or so in the United States. So, I mean, it doesn't seem possible for them to leave back to Mexico. It doesn't seem Mexico wouldn't want to accept them. So, you know, it's a tough issue.
Well, that doesn't change the fact that you cannot grant amnesty to them. You should not. You cannot grant social services to them. You can't make it amiable for millions more to come into the country. It's a scourge on the United States, the illegal immigration invasion from the South, and for the political people that want to grant amnesty and pass more social services, which is what that health care bill did in a lot of cases. It's further anti-white bills. It's a keystone in anti-white legislation by the U.S. government. They have to crack down on illegal immigration. They have to seal the border, and they have to shut down social services for these people, and they cannot grant amnesty to them. So if the Republican Party votes entirely against Obama's amnesty legislation, then it'll make a strong statement about the Republican Party and who their constituents are.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Mexico, I think, actually wants illegal immigrants here because it displaces a lot of their population that's unemployed.
No, definitely.
And the illegals, they send money back to Mexico.
Yeah, the Mexican government produces leaflets and flyers on information on how to cross the border successfully, where to find water and food and camp and sleep. So there's official government papers produced to help people migrate to the United States. The Mexican government's in favor of it. And, every time you see the president of Mexico or government officials trying to dress down American government agents. You're trying to dress down the American president. It happened with Bush many times. Have the president of Mexico dressing him down whenever he would talk about illegal immigration in the country. The Mexicans just the Mexican government is just extremely arrogant in the fact that Mexicans will obviously be migrating to your country, and that's the way it is, and you're not going to say anything about it. So if the Republicans, once again, if the Republicans oppose it, they're going to be standing up for American interests when presidents and when the government of the United States has always been scared of the Mexican government. Every time the Mexican government says anything to them, they cower in fear like they have something to be afraid of with the Mexican government.
Yeah, but I think fortunately, I mean, most whites and blacks do, at least, they do oppose illegal immigration. And I don't think that they're for amnesty, so
no.
I think that could be on our side.
Yeah, I think so. So when we come down to it, I think these are the days that try the Republicans' souls. So we're going to find out how the Republicans respond to this. It's going to be much more telling than the health care bill was.
Okay. Thanks, Derek. Right.
Thanks, Marty. All right, well, that's the conclusion of our program today. Had a lot of good talk. And check out Craig Boedeker's website, aconversationaboutrace.com. The title of his film is A Conversation About Race. Very interesting. He was our guest today. Very well made. And I'll see you again on Tuesday. You'll hear me again on Tuesday.
Yes, Derek is going on assignment Tuesday. He'll be here by satellite. If the satellite's up, we're going to have to hope the satellite doesn't go down.
I'll be out in the Caribbean, but I'll still be with you in spirit and in voice. So.
Absolutely. I'll be here holding down the fort, but you will be here, of course. Not sure who our guest will be. We'll find somebody.
Yeah, it'll be a good show. So tune in Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in today. This is the Derek Black Show on 1340 AM WPBR. Well, see you around.
Thank you for listening to the Derek Black Show on WPBR 1340 AM. Tune in on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 to 11 a.m. Thank you.
The opinions heard on this program were those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not represent those of WPBR, its management, staff, or advertisers.
This is WPBR, Lantana, Lake Worth, and all of the Palm Beaches.